Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Religion on the New Books Network. My name is Diana Dehanova, and I will be your host. Today I'm speaking with Adam Siegel, Researcher Services Librarian at UC Davis, and Dietra Cohen, Family Herbalist. We're going to be discussing their 2021 book, Ashkenazi Herbalism, Rediscovering the Herbal Traditions of Eastern European Jews. Adam and Dietra, welcome to the program, and thank you very much for joining me today.
Thank you, Diana. We're very excited to talk with you.
Yes, thank you. It's an honor to be on the program.
So let's start. Can you tell us a little bit about your backgrounds and how you came to be interested both generally in herbalism and specifically this project?
I, for many years, was a librarian, a reference librarian in public libraries, and grew up in Philadelphia, which is kind of what I like to think of as a bunch of little villages strung together in a very forested area. And so I grew up around nature and I was always really interested in plants and the natural world. And after I retired from being a librarian, I decided to pursue my studies in herbalism. And that's kind of a roundabout way of saying how I became interested. But those are kind of the areas that brought together my specific interest in describing herbalism from a specific point of view.
And I was trained as basically an Eastern European linguist and have done a lot of research on cultural contact in Central and Eastern Europe, particularly in the former Soviet Union, former Czechoslovakia, the former Yugoslavia, all the formers, Poland. And interesting plants. And also I have, in my librarian job, I've done a lot of research on plants in Eastern Europe, particularly grapes and wine, olives, and to a certain extent, T. Camellia sinensis.
So I wanted to kind of start with basic questions, because I think herbal medicine is something I think everyone thinks they know what it is, but a lot of people don't. So let's start with that. What is herbal medicine, and then what role has it traditionally played in Ashkenazi culture?
Connection cut out a little bit, but I think what you asked was, what is herbal medicine and how did it affect Ashkenazim?
That's right.
Okay. Well, herbal medicine is something that has been around since time immemorial, and basically it's human interest in the natural world, specifically the plants around them, and their abilities to heal and keep in balance the body's systems. And in particular to Ashkenazim, they were and continue to be part of the natural world and cultures that have been one of the cultures that have been knowledgeable in this area from probably time immemorial. And we know that from looking at the Hebrew Bible, that many plants are mentioned there in the context of healing and health. So I guess that kind of puts Ashkenazim and Jews in general into that context.
Now, you write that, you know, there's been relatively little research on this topic. You write in the afterword, quote, "This book is as much a piece of detective work as it is a guide." So could you talk a bit about your experience in discovering the sources as you were working on this project?
Oh, sure. Yeah, I mean, that, right. That's, you know, that's in some ways, you know, the, for us, certainly that was the fun part. You know, Dietrich's, you know, this project was an outgrowth of her studies. And, you know, so what she was faced with when being asked in her Western herbalist tradition training was to sort of look at her own ancestral, plant and healing knowledge. You know, she couldn't find anything. There was nothing, you know, there was certainly no one place you could go to. You couldn't go to the library and say, show me all the books on Jewish herbalism, because there weren't any, or show me anything about, you know, plant knowledge among Eastern European Jews, or any, you know, there wasn't anything. And so that set, you know, that basically was the impetus for this research journey. I mean, I can skip ahead. I'll let her go back because it's really, you know, the struggle that she engaged with and how she sort of broke through.
Yeah, that's true. When I first started studying herbalism more formally, one of the things that you find when you study, especially with in a school, is that the teachers and most herbalists will want to know the traditions that your family would have relied on. And in my case, they were wondering about our parents or our grandparents. And most of the people in my class at that point had some sort of anecdote that they could tell. And when it came my turn to talk about it, I really could come up with not very much. I mean, my mother had given us tea with lemon and honey. Honey seemed to be something that was a recurring remedy in our household. But other than that, I couldn't come up with anything. And that was my initial impetus for really wanting to find out more, because my own grandparents had come here to the United States from Eastern Europe. And I knew that because they had grown up in basically a shtetl, that there had to be something that they had looked to medicinally, because, I don't know, it just seemed like natural. And so when I started researching, because as a librarian, I haven't been a librarian for many years, I was like very curious to dig into the literature. And so I fully expected to find all kinds of information, because there's so much that's written on the Pale and life in the Pale. But as soon as I started looking, I was shocked and amazed that there's really nothing in English, or as I found out later, when Adam began to help me with the project, that what there is kind of like this diaspora of little tiny nuggets and sparks of information all over the place, and very surprising and unexpected places in all kinds of languages. But you have to be willing and able to really dig through so much literature and also be able to read between the lines. And so that's kind of, I hope, answering your question. There's a little more to that, and I can talk about that if you'd like.
Yeah, please go on.
Kind of early on in my research, I had found three books that had been published in the 20th century. They weren't specifically, as far as I knew, on Jewish herbalism in the Pale, which is where both sides of my family come from. but they were from adjacent populations that I figured, well, you know, my family lived amongst these people. There must have been some sort of, you know, osmosis that happened at some point with this knowledge. And these mm-hmm. three books, one of them was on Russian herbalism, the other was on Polish herbalism, and the third one was called Herbs Used in Ukrainian Folk Medicine. And so these were the books that I relied on throughout my studies, because so much of the work that we were doing required us to talk about possible ancestral knowledge. So this went on for about a year, and I was really looking at these books for their plant knowledge. And then steps led to me continuing to search for more specific details about possible Ashkenazi herbalism. And I would find little tiny hints of it all over the place in really unexpected sources. One of these was a bottle of bitters that was pictured in the Holocaust memorial site. And when I looked closely at it, I thought it was a milk bottle. But when I zoomed in to get a better picture of it, it turned out to be a bottle of bitters that was produced by a Jewish company in Posen, Poland. And used herbs like gentian. And if any of your listeners are herbalists, they will know that gentian is one of the bitter herbs that is used in things like aperitifs that are taken before eating a meal that help the digestion process and the salivation process that help break down food. So this was a clue that I found that was very exciting. And yet it wasn't enough for me, because I wanted to know if this was one herb, there had to be more. And so I found other clues. Another was about a list of women's practices in a town in Sanek, also in Poland, before the war, that was listed in a book called the Shtetl Book, which is kind of a classic from the 70s. So this list of women's professions included a herb vendor and a couple of other professions that were also significant. One of them was a medic. Another one was an Absprecherin, and another was a syrup maker and also a bathhouse attendant. So later on, I was to find that all of these professions contributed their knowledge to Ashkenazi herbalism in general, in the shtetls. But at the time, I didn't know. And so I continued searching. And another big breakthrough for me came from a book called And Prairie Dogs Weren't Kosher, which is a funny title, but it is the stories of these women who came from the Pale Settlement. They were all Jewish and who pioneered the upper Midwest in the United States in the late 1800s and early 1900s. And one of these stories comes from a woman, her granddaughter, who talked about her grandmother, who's from a town in Ukraine called Kreslev. And her grandmother was a midwife. She was also an herbalist. And she delivered her granddaughter in Grand Forks, North Dakota. And she also was able to go to the pharmacy in North Dakota without knowing English, being able to read it or speak it. And she could go into these pharmacies and pick out the herbs that she needed for healing in her family. And I'm assuming she could pick them out by sight, by smell, by taste, and she could take home the herbs and make the medicine, prepare the medicine that her family needed. And so when I found out that this woman was from Ukraine, I decided I needed to find out more about these people. Here was this Jewish woman from Kreslev, Ukraine. And I went back to the book that I had earlier looked at only for plant knowledge. This is a book. Again, it's called Herbs Used in Ukrainian Folk Medicine. I had often and always assumed that it had been talking about ethnic Ukrainians. And so I went back to this book because even though it doesn't speak about any population in specific, it does list the towns where the anonymous informants came from. And one of these towns was Kreslev. So I decided to go through the list in the back of the book, which is an alphabetical appendix of the towns where the informants came from. And if you look at this book, it's 114 pages. It's very short. It's part of a mimeographed series that came out in 1952. What can I say about it? The data that was gathered for this document had been gathered between the wars. So between World War I and World War II, the Soviet government had undertaken all kinds of ethnobotanical studies because they had run out of medicines after the First World War, and they were looking for inexpensive ways to heal their people. And so one of these ethnobotanical expeditions had gone to Ukraine. And this book was taken from part of the data from those field works. And it was saved and preserved by this woman who had been on these expeditions. She was a Ukrainian woman. She had survived the war and she had made it to the United States in probably the late 40s. And by 1952, had published an excerpt from this data that she had literally brought to the United States in at least one suitcase. So this is the data that I had been looking at. And if you are looking at that book, it's really about the plant medicine and the way the informants had told about their knowledge and how they had used the plants. And so when the book talks about each plant, it lists the towns. But when I was looking at them, the towns listed in that part of the book are very abbreviated and hard to decipher. And so I had never paid much attention to them until I decided to look at this appendix. So as I started to go through the appendix alphabetically, what was coming up as I did really informal searches on the internet was the first hit that I would get on about 75% of the towns was Jewish Gen. And if any of your listeners are familiar with Jewish Gen, it's a website that deals with genealogy of Ashkenazim and other groups of Jews from Europe and Eastern Europe in particular. And so I had done a lot of genealogy with some of my cousins. And so I was very familiar with the site. And so every time the site would come up, I would think, that's odd. And then other sites that would come up right underneath it were things like Shtetl Finder and Yad Vashem and a bunch of other sites that talked about memorializing the towns that had been devastated in the Holocaust. So I was sitting in the living room and Adam, my husband and co-author, was sitting next to me. And I turned to him and I said, do you think this is significant? And you can imagine what he said. And so that was a humongous breakthrough for me. And I spent 6 months after that going through each one of these towns and really, really investigating the name of the town, what the population breakdown was, using things like this source that was put together after the Holocaust called Where Once We Walked, the Lippincott Gazetteer from 1952. Adam helped me with the Russian census of 1926. And I also put together a map where I pinned all the towns where you can see exactly where they were, because I had no idea where some of these places, any of them were. And then I also put together a handmade graph and an online spreadsheet of each plant, specifically where it was told about by the informants in the surveys. And many, many patterns emerged from taking this data and really contextualizing it. So that's kind of really the beginning of our research. I was encouraged after doing all this. I did my final paper for my class, for my program, on the data that I found, and kind of put together an anecdotal paper for my class, and then I was encouraged by one of our ethnobotanical teachers to have the article published, and I did that in the Journal of the American Herbalists Guild. And then I realized that other people would be really interested in this, and so I decided to kind of take it around to different publishers, and North Atlantic was very excited and supportive of our idea. And then really that's when our super extensive research started. And I can let Adam finish with that if you'd like.
Oh, yeah. Right. Because at that point, basically, Dietrich was able to use herbs used in Ukrainian folk medicine as sort of a skeleton key to confirm that, you know, these towns that before the war had Jewish populations of up to
70, 80,
yeah, 100%, some of them, and some were lower. I mean, big towns, small towns, that you could sort of reconstruct, do a sort of forensic reconstruction of the actual materia medica of Ashkenazi herbalists, the herbalist community. And at that point, you know, along the way, you know, Dietrich talked about, you know, women's trades in Sanok in Poland, and you going through some of the English language historiography of Jewish history led us into the Yiddish language, you know, historiography. So we spent a lot of time, not enough because we didn't have that much time, but we spent a lot of time looking at Yizkor books, memory books from, you know, the communities that were mostly compiled after the war by survivors. We had to sort of look at the history of ethnographic research in Russia from the, like, the late 19th century up until the First World War with the Jewish ethnographic program, the Anski expeditions, Yivo's work in Poland in the 20s and 30s, basically having to map out an entire world of folk medicine in Jewish communities, you know, culminating, you know, in the late 30s. And it was a lot of reading. It was a lot of squinting at itty bitty footnotes in Cyrillic and Yiddish. And but we ended up with being able to tell a story of, you know, Jewish medicine, both traditional and folk medicine, in the Pale from, you know, the 17th century up until the 20th. And then Dietrich selected, and it was a sort of an intentional selection of 26 representative, it's not the whole materia medica, but it's a nice representative collection of plants that are important, not just for the Ashkenazi Jewish community, but for also for, you know, in Eastern Europe in general.
I can certainly see why you described it as a detective work, especially the early stages of it that you described, Dietrich. Even more so than I think research usually is. I wish we had more time to talk about this Ukrainian woman in North Dakota, because that sounds like a really fascinating story.
Yeah, it really is. The story in that book in Prairie Dogs Weren't Kosher, it's really a very short anecdote, but it was, you know, amazing. And so many of the things that I found were just totally stumbled upon. And that's pretty much kind of how we've been working, is kind of lurching from one of these just amazing stories that, you know, pops out to the next and the next and the next. And it's just kind of been very kind of, I don't know what the word would be, just stumbling, nonstop stumbling. But that's how it's been, and that's how it continues to be. And it's just, you know, fun and exciting, and also just, I don't know. it's been a trip, and it continues to be.
Great. Well, I wanted to get a little bit more into the history. Going back to sort of the introduction to the book, you write that a lot of Ashkenazi communities by the turn of the 20th century were still very reluctant to embrace modernity, right? And modern medicine was a part of that. So instead, they relied a lot on traditional healers. So could you talk about the role of healers in these communities before World War II?
Well, I would say, let Adam pick up on this, but I'll start by saying that probably in the smallest towns and, you know, the middle-sized towns, there weren't a lot of, there wasn't a lot of access to more, you know, contemporary medicine. And what there was wasn't really trusted by the people who lived in the in these places, and they were more familiar with their traditional healers, like the Felchers and the midwives and the Apsprecherins, because the people who came in who had been more formally educated often didn't speak the language of the people. They often refused to speak the language of the people and instead spoke the language of the dominant culture. And that put people off because they were used to having this more intimate ability to speak with the people who they were looking to for healing. And because it's an intimate relationship to tell somebody, you know, what's bothering you and, you know, how can it help you? It's, and so, you know, there's a lot of trust that's involved there. And if the person who you're having to go to doesn't speak your language and there is somebody who does, it's, I'm guessing, way more comfortable to go with the more familiar. And so that seems to be what was going on in these communities. And even people from the big cities would often come back to their smaller towns to visit the traditional healers who they trusted with their health. Did you want to go on with that?
Oh yeah. I mean, just this past week, we were looking at a Yizkor for our next project. And there was sort of a brief description of attitudes toward medical care in this town. I think it's Khorodits, which is, you know, in Podolia, I think. There were no doctor. There was one Felcher who was also a dentist and who had been a barber. And if he didn't help you, and I guess he often didn't, you then went to a bobe, who was, you know, that which would, you know, means grandmother, but it could refer to a midwife, it could refer to an exorcist. A znachor or a znachorka, which is the Slavic equivalent of an apsprecher or apsprecherin. I don't think that particular community distinguished between, you know, Jewish and non-Jewish exorcists, or, you know, or you would just get what they call zogarkis, or to pray for you, bedrkis. But in a lot of towns, if there was a trained doctor, they may have been there under duress. You know, they were Jewish because of the pale restrictions on, you know, even if you were, could get yourself to, you know, to Danzig or Berlin to study medicine formally, when you came back to Russia, you still had to live in the pale. So, you know, that was not necessarily where they wanted to be. They were charging for their services, whereas a lot of, you know, traditional healers, you know, it was sort of a point, you know, that was, you, what would you call it? Not even a point of pride. It was simply part of the culture where you don't, this is, it's not, it's bad. Mm-hmm. It's bad to demand any compensation for this. This is simply done. And there was simply, depending on the town, there was an array, but you could, a typical town would have probably a Felcher, a surgeon, or a paramedic. There would be usually one or two midwives, one Jewish, one non-Jewish. There would be healers who work with supernatural forces, typically the ones who could combat the evil eye, and the midwives. I already mentioned the midwives, but yeah, that's, maybe there was a doctor, maybe there wasn't. Sometimes some towns in Poland had a hospital that was run by the Catholic Church.
There were, the Jewish hospitals, or the
Hekdesh. Yeah. There were Jewish hospitals, there were Jewish community. But if you look at the book, I mean, their reputation was generally along a scale, the closer you got to
Western
medicine or state institutions, the lower the level of trust.
Yeah.
So the further you got away from that, culminating in absolute, you know, trust and devotion for, you know, Bobe, you know, quote, untrained midwives, as opposed to akusherke, trained midwives.
Who could also be felchers.
Who could also be felchers. But yeah, I mean, it's a complex story. We really discussed it in, you know, we felt like we offer like the most succinct summation of a really complex history of medicine in Jewish communities in Eastern Europe. And, you know, it's like 20,000 words. So there's a lot of stuff that, yeah, we didn't even talk about the historical figures like the, you know, the Bali Shem, the religious healers, or you want to.
Sure. Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccoli, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Oh, well, yeah, the Bali Shem were known as the practical Kabbalists, and they, this is probably the Middle Ages, possibly earlier, into after the Enlightenment period, and they healed with amulets that they would compose for people, and also herbs that they drew their knowledge from these remedy books that could be composed of information from many different sources. Some of them were translations of Western doctors' medicine that were translated into Hebrew or Yiddish. Some of them were drawn from their knowledge of local communities like Slavic medicine, and even had a lot of Slavic terms in them. And when they healed, they used the Hebrew or Aramaic language, as opposed to the women who always spoke in Yiddish or the dialects of the people. So even though they were popular among the people, they weren't as popular as the women, from what we read, because again, they were speaking in the language of the Bible, you know, and not the language of the people. So my takeaway from reading all of this is that people always felt more comfortable with things that they felt at home with and could relate to and could trust just with all of themselves, you know, because the healer was speaking their language.
So can you say more about the impact of the opening of Russian medical schools to Jews that happened in the 1850s, especially in light of this kind of distrust for the outside world, and particularly the sort of scientific language versus the language of the people?
I mean, yeah, it did have an impact. I mean, but I would say the impact was sort of, you know, it's really a part of a much broader sort of state investment in public health. You know, one of those things that you sort of pass over until you work on a book during a pandemic, you know, is you notice that, you know, there were a lot of stuff happened around these cholera outbreaks in Russia in like the 1890s. They were every like 3-5 years, there was a cholera outbreak that sort of swept through the Pale. And that sort of led to massive, by our, I guess, our standards, massive investments in, like, you know, country, you know, rural healthcare, we'd call it the Zemstvo. And that required, it allowed for Jews from different strata of society to enroll in professional medical education, sometimes as medical doctors, much more often as sort of certified felchers, certified midwives, certified nurses. And because they were not on dentists, right? And because they were not, you know, intelligent, they weren't, you know, the really, you know, Jews from, you know, the merchant class, who, the ones who could afford to go off to Berlin to study medicine and didn't, and when they came back, wanted to only practice in St. Petersburg. These were going to be aspiring medical healthcare professionals who were perfectly content to go back to their towns and villages to serve the people. I mean, I can't imagine, we didn't look at that in any way closely, but I can't imagine there wasn't a correlation between, you know, political viewpoint, social democracy, Bundes, et cetera, and one's willingness to sort of go off, get trained, and then go back to serve the community. How it actually impacted the overall health of the communities. We looked at some of the larger public health literature that, you know, noted things like infant mortality rates in Jewish communities were much lower than in the surrounding communities, and that may as well have been laws around ritual cleanliness as anything else. It's hard to say, but certainly right up until the eve of the war, the people relied on traditional healers for almost everything. And there's a real tension, you know, in a lot of the literature that we reviewed, especially from, you know, sources like Ivo. There's a really amazing book which has been translated into English called Frog Under the Tongue by Mark Tushevitsky, who's a Polish scholar. It's a fantastic book, and your readers should definitely, it's published by University of Liverpool Press.
Yeah.
Fantastic book. So glad it's in English. And, you know, he's looked at sort of this, the sort of like quizzical disbelief, I guess, that a lot of trained doctors, especially in Poland between the wars, who were sort of bewildered by the fact that, you know, they were bringing, you know, modern medical care to these communities, and yet people still preferred the old ways, which, you know, to me hardly seems surprising to us, but certainly that tension existed right up until the war. And it made some of our research a little bit more challenging because in many cases, this ethnography is about all you have to go on. So especially like the Anski expeditions, they would go on a great length about, you know, the mystical, you know, the hocus pocus stuff, but they would ignore the fact that they were working with informants who actually had plant remedies that they were using as well. And then they would just say, oh, and she gave me some tea and I drank it and I felt better. But, you know, who knows? They wouldn't tell you what was in the tea. And the informants may not have told them, because a lot of that was secret knowledge.
I mean, I think it's kind of probably an obvious comment, but as an Ashkenazi Jew from Russia myself, knowing the massive cultural capital that doctors now hold in our culture and in Jewish communities, it's kind of something humorous about looking back, thinking that not so long ago, there was a time that there was all this distrust.
Yeah, yeah. And I don't know if that's necessarily, I mean, that I, you know, I think that, you know, but over during the Soviet era is when that shift took place. And also mm-hmm. because, and that's one thing that we ran into, but we didn't look at. I mean, even the herbs used in Ukrainian folk medicine, all that research was conducted by, you know, state institutes for botany, experimental medicine, pharmacology. So and even some of the other things that we relied on as sort of comparative cross checks, things like Nosel and Nosel and Zemlinsky and, you know, the Müller-Dietz, which is a German compendium. The Soviet medicine relied heavily on plant medicine, and they openly acknowledged the debt. You know, it wasn't, you know, like Western, you know, capitalist medicine where you can, you know, you occlude the fact that you're taking, you know, nature and then taking it into a lab and coming out with some intellectual property. So I would imagine, and just, you know, a comprehensive system of free medical care is going to make people over time much more, you know, trusting and accepting of you know, modern medicine. But yeah, again, certainly right. the recognition that that plants can do and want to heal, I think is much more, even some of I'm sort of wandering off topic, I guess, or I'm talking about things that I'm not as sharp on, things like the concept of like the adaptogen, which is a very, 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 yeah. very important term in modern herbal medicine. That comes straight from Breckman. Yeah, and their work on rhodiola and Siberian plants, and you know, in the 60s and 70s and 80s, and that's like crucial, amazingly important revelatory work, and it came out of a tradition that was not interested in monetizing it or exploiting it, as far as it could tell. It's really exciting stuff, and we're sort of happy that we have a new project that's allowing us to look more deeply into that body of work.
Mm-hmm. So there was one other thing that you mentioned before, and we can sort of just touch on it because I know it's not something you went into in too much detail, but the role of the supernatural, so sort of an understanding and diagnosing and healing illness, and the relationship between sort of the supernatural and using prayer and things of that nature to heal illness. How was that intertwined with herbal medicine?
In the more modern era, the Absprechers or Absprecherins would use ritual to handle cases that involve the evil eye. And the evil eye is a concept that probably goes back before the Hebrew Bible. And it can manifest in many different ways. In the pale, probably the most common rituals against the evil eye were done for children who suffered from fear, and that could show up as anything from a rash to a bedwetting. And so the ritual that we came upon over and over again was something that we call the wax ceremony. And that involved having the patient sit down in a bowl of water, cool water was held over their head, and a lump of something with a low melting point, like wax, that's probably the most popular in the pale, was melted and then put into this water and allowed to harden. And that was done 3 times. And while it was being done, the person was talking about their fear, and the practitioner was reciting these incantations. Sometimes it was in Yiddish. We found one that was in Ukrainian that was spoken or whispered, I should say, by the Absprecherin, because all of these incantations were done by whispering. And then the wax or other substance was interpreted by the healer, and that would tell where the fear came from and how to cure it. And while we're not sure exactly what herbs were used by these women all the time or the extent of the herbs that they used, we do know for a fact that certain herbs have been passed down, because I spoke recently to an Absprecherin, a Jewish Absprecherin in Israel, who told me that she uses garlic, rue, salt, and sugar. So we know of at least two herbs that were known by these women that have been passed down to this living person in Israel. I'm fairly certain that for protection, they also knew to apply St. John's mm-hmm. wort, which in Yiddish was known as Shadim, which means demons, Shutz, which means protection from. So those are several herbs that we're aware of that were in the repertoire of these healers who performed, I guess in contemporary language would be called exorcisms. Did you want to add?
One thing that was, it's super interesting, is just how syncretic these practices are. The descriptions, one of the books that Dietra relied on was The Word and Wax.
The Word and Wax.
Which is documents the wax pouring ceremony among Ukrainian Canadians in the prairies.
Who came from Podolia.
Podolia, the same region. And in many cases, the charms are identical. Yiddish language accounts of that we find in the Yizkors, basically refer to what they're doing as, shebshit, which is like basically a Yiddishification of the verb shiptat, to whisper. Shiptuhi, they call them, but it's always like in quotes, whisperers. Again, like Dietra said, the charms could be intoned in Yiddish or in Ukrainian. And it's sort of fun to see one of the Anski ethnographers transcribing this charm, in Yiddish, Yiddish letters, and then having to sort of run it back into, in Cyrillic, or to see what it looks like, so you can make sense of it. But it was absolutely the case where the two communities adopted a common set of practices, rituals, beliefs, and the directionality. The transmission of knowledge, I think, ran freely in both ways.
Mm-hmm. Now, I wanted to get into the bulk of the book, which, as you mentioned, is a materia medica, a body of collected knowledge about the therapeutic properties used for healing. And there you describe 26 plants that are, quote, known by folk healers in the Pale of Settlement with a significant Jewish population between the two world wars. And you mentioned that this is a selection and that there were more that you looked at. So can you talk about how you chose those plants and maybe a few that you found particularly interesting?
It was really a struggle on which plants to choose, because there are so many. And so I, in some ways, some of these are kind of randomly in the book, because I certainly could have chosen a different plant. I would say for the most part, my criteria was that the plant be known by the communities with the highest population of Ashkenazim before World War II. And so that probably would be the majority of the plants. And then there were a few that I chose that were outside of that known demographic. And those were things that were a little bit more, I like the stories about them. One of those would be nutmeg. And I just was just amazed at the story, which is kind of like incidental in this book called Memoirs of a Grandmother by the original author is Pauline Wengeroff, and it's translated by I can't remember the translator's name. Do you remember her? I think her last name's Magnus. And in that story, the author remembers her husband's grandmother, who had been a midwife and an apprentice in this town called Conatip. And she used all kinds of herbs. And this is like unprecedented that this woman had remembered the herbs that this herbalist and midwife had used. And one of the herbs, I mean, out of the handful that are mentioned, is nutmeg. And I was just blown away that nutmeg was known in the Pale in the late 1800s. And so I did some research on how did it get there and, you know, what is this all about? And so I kind of told the story of nutmeg. And what I found was this woman seemed to know that nutmeg was a plant that could help in helping somebody rest and sleep. And she gave it to her granddaughter-in-law to help after the birth of the first child in that family. The woman was able to sleep after giving birth and, you know, convalesce successfully. And so that was really just fascinating to me that, you know, just to pick out that very personal story on this plant that I just found so surprising to exist and be known in the Pale at that time. So that's one story of one plant. Another plant that I chose that was outside of those reasons was raspberry, because it was known in the Pale as a syrup, is what I found. And in my family, my grandparents always had it on the table, a jam of raspberry. And so it was exciting for me to find that raspberry syrup was a remedy, a very common remedy that syrup makers made. And it was like a medicine that was given to children and probably other people who were trying to heal from a cold or the flu or what have you. And it was just an important medicine, so important that it was even faked in some towns by adding a lot of sugar and dyes to it. And that was the less expensive version of it than the actual syrup that was made from the berries themselves. So those were two plants that kind of were more personal to me. The whole idea of that materia medica was I really wanted to see how these plants became known in these small villages by these traditional healers. And so I really wanted to put them like in a historical and geographic kind of context and see, you know, how do these uses in the shtetls compare to other places in the world and at other times? And kind of what I found was a lot of this knowledge came from the Greeks and probably the Egyptians before them. And so that was really interesting. And a couple of plants were not mentioned in Dioscorides. And I, you know, still wonder if they were just a local knowledge that, you know, had just kind of been pioneered by that region. So there's still a lot of mysteries around the plants of that time and place.
And I'll just add, this is one thing that we found kind of interesting. We haven't really talked about yet, sort of like a Sherlock Holmes dog that didn't bark. Because when we went through, we were going through herbs used in Ukrainian folk medicine. And again, if you look at the title, you think, well, they're talking about, you know, Ukrainian folk medicine, you know, folk medicine as practiced by Ukrainians. And nowhere in that book do they mention Viburnum opulus, Kalina. What's it, Guelder Rose? Is that what it is in English?
Guelder Rose.
Yeah, Kalina, which is, you know, basically like the national flower of Ukraine. And it's certainly known, you know, if you look at the Russian-Ukrainian works on folk medicine, it shows up, you know, it's, and so the fact that it didn't show up anywhere in this book, you know, we thought was kind of interesting. I don't know if it's because they weren't asking about it or if their informants, maybe that showed that, you know, it's used, you know, there are plants that were definitely more used by Jewish communities than non-Jewish communities and vice versa.
Yeah. I mean, when I located all the towns on the map and I put together the spreadsheet that identified the towns that were reported in each, I mean, the plants that were reported in each town, you could see different patterns emerging. The towns that were located on the right side of the Dnieper River definitely were known to use different plants than the towns on the left side, left bank of that river, where there were less frequent Jewish communities. And so that was kind of interesting and definitely deserves more exploration and research.
Great. So as we get to sort of the end of our time together, what do you hope will be the sort of key takeaway for readers?
Well, that's interesting and complicated. And for me, as somebody of Ashkenazi descent who was baffled by this lack of knowledge, I hope that people take away that we also had a tradition, and it was very rich, and it was widely practiced, and it was well regarded. And at the same time, I feel like the plants shouldn't really be claimed by any one ethnicity or any one group of people, because they exist in their own right and they belong to nobody. They belong to themselves. And that was something that came to me towards the end of doing all this research, that, you know, to colonize plants is just, I don't know, it just seems wrong to me. But to have a tradition, you know, that respects the plants and the knowledge of the people, you know, that seems important, if that makes any sense.
Mm-hmm. And Adam, did you want to add anything?
One of the things that were, again, not only, you know, this recognition of the plants and their autonomy and their generosity, but the fact that the communities, I mean, clearly there was so much intercommunal aid and assistance that comes through again and again and again. I mean, so much of the received history you get is it was nothing but pogroms all the time, but it wasn't. There were communities where for years, everybody would, accounts of, there's everybody in this town, everybody went to the Polish midwife, you know, because she was the best midwife. Or everybody, you know, everybody went and saw the you'd go 20 kilometers to go to the Tatar, you know, in some little village out in the countryside in Lithuania. And we're looking at that intercommunal, overall culture of healing.
That was so exciting to see, just really, just so heartening, especially, you know, in terms of thinking that people got along, you know, in the past when, you know, everything that we have read about the past has said the opposite. And it just gives us both hope for, you know, the present and the future, that, you know, we can all come together to heal and to take care of each other, you know, and the plants can help that. They have helped in the past, and it seems like, you know, they're here to help us, you know, now and into the future.
Absolutely. I think that that's a great note to end on. And I really do think this is such a wonderful service, not just to the Ashkenazi kind of global community and Ashkenazi history, which I agree can be just so bleak. So it's great to read something so positive, but just to also the herbalist community. So that is all the time we have. So thank you for listening to New Books in Religion on the New Books Network. And we've been talking about Ashkenazi herbalism, rediscovering the herbal traditions of Eastern European Jews. And Ashkenazi herbalism is now available from North Atlantic Books. Adam and Dietra, thank you again for joining me for this fascinating conversation.
Oh, Diana, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure. It's been great talking to you. Thank you so much.
Yes, thank you. Thank you so much for this opportunity.